And welcome back to Miller and Moulton, millerandmoulton.com, Miller underscore Moulton on X. Opening day Major League Baseball is later today. Andy Fried, voice of the Rays, Kyle Seeloff, voice of the Marlins, they will join us next hour. This hour, we begin with the legendary Vern Lundquist, who is wrapping up his broadcasting career in a little less than 3 weeks when he calls his final and 40th Masters on CBS. Vern, it's David and Mark. Thanks for doing this. How are you?
I'm doing fine, guys. Well, one of you I know very well, Mark. I have met you, but I'm fascinated to be on the show with you. That other guy that you know, I've known for years.
So we'll do the Masters in a bit. You did local TV in Texas. You ended up in Dallas in the mid-60s, right? When did you get your first network TV gig?
After I was lucky enough to get the Cowboys radio broadcast, I started with the Cowboy radio broadcast in 67 as the pre- and post-game show host. And in that role, I went to the Ice Bowl. I was there freezing like everybody else in 1967. I did the pre and post for a couple of years. Then I was the color guy. And then Bill Mercer, who was the play-by-play guy, had always wanted to do baseball. And the Senators moved to Texas and became the Rangers. And Bill moved over there. And Tex Schramm hired me as the play-by-play guy. So I was the play-by-play broadcaster for Dallas from 72 to 83. And I had a chance to go to Los Angeles at one point, and Tex said, "What do you want to do in 10 years?" And I said, "I'd love to do network play-by-play." And he said, "Don't go to L.A. because there are 5,000 guys out there more qualified than you are. Stay here, and if you're any good, and I obviously think you can do it, the network will find you." And that is what happened. In 74, I got a call from ABC Sports. And so the first network game I did was a regional in September of 74, Ohio University at Kent State. And there was a graduate assistant on the Kent State staff who wound up being a pretty good football coach. His name was Nick Saban. And I got to know Nick very, very well over the years when I was doing SEC football. And we used to have some fun pretending like we remembered each other during that September game in 74.
Was football the sport you always wanted to do?
Well, it's the one with which I felt most comfortable. I grew up in the South, here in Austin, where I'm speaking to you from right now, from where I am speaking to you. Nonsense up with which I will not put, as Winston Churchill once said. But I grew up in a Texas football culture. And so that was the one I really felt comfortable doing. And that, you know, I think fortunately for me, that was the first assignment I was asked to fulfill. And then, you know, it branched out. That work with ABC, I was a part-timer there, never a full-timer. And it came to an end. I got one of the dreaded phone calls that we all get at some point. We're moving in a different direction. And so I was wandering around Dallas, recently married to Nancy, and all of a sudden I got a call from a fellow who had been at ABC and gone to CBS. And he said, it ain't much, but we can start you with 6 college football games and 2 basketball. So that was my initial contract with CBS in 82. And fortunately for me, they, you know, the work expanded. And the biggest break I got then after I'd gone to CBS was when Frank Cicchini had called me and said, "Have you ever done any golf?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, about 10 or 12. He said, "Well, we're going to try you on golf." And that really was pivotal for all the good things that have happened to me since.
You told me once that you kind of knew your days at ABC were up when the entire network went to Lake Placid to do the Olympics except you.
You got that right. You know what I did? They called me and said, you didn't make the cut for Lake Placid. Heck, I didn't make the cut for Innsbruck in 76. And in Lake Placid, I was sent to Peoria, Illinois, to substitute for, what was his name? He's passed away now. One of the guys who, Dave Dials. He did the studio for ABC. He was at Lake Placid. So I went to Lake Placid and filled in for him on a bowling show or something like that. And I kind of knew then that I was not tilting in the right direction. And then when 80 came, and then that was in 76 in Innsbruck, and in 80, the 80 is when I knew I was cooked. And that's when I just didn't get to work in Lake Placid. In Innsbruck. Right. Matter of fact, I did my first golf tournament in 1976 when I didn't get to Innsbruck, and I got a call from a guy named Terry Jastrow, and he said, I know you're disappointed, but this might make you feel better. You're going to be at the Hawaiian Open at Wailea Country Club. So that did salve the wound a little bit.
We'll get to the Masters in a moment, and we're talking with the legendary Vern Lundquist. I do want to get you to tell a story that I don't know if we've ever gotten you to tell on our airwaves. Can you tell the Daryl Royal, Mrs. Royal story?
David, I sure can. I got to work with Coach Royal. I had two idols when I was growing up, the late Doak Walker and the late Daryl Royal. And, both. Beg your pardon?
Nope. No, go ahead.
Say anything.
Oh, okay. We lived full time in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, and Doak lived there, and I got to know him really well. And he and I co-sponsored a charity golf event for 15 years, and we became very, very good friends. And then Coach Royal and I got to work together. I got my start here in Austin 61 years ago. Good gosh almighty. And I covered UT because that's what you did in Austin. Got to know Coach Royal. So in 1980, he had retired from Texas in 76, and we were paired together at ABC. And so we're doing a college football game in Manhattan, Kansas. And believe me, there's a distinct difference in the big Manhattan and the little Manhattan. And we're flying back. We drove to Kansas City, flew back to Dallas. We got to Dallas, and he said, this is Saturday afternoon, the evening. He said, what are you doing tomorrow? And I said, well, I don't have anything planned because the Cowboys have a Monday night game. He said, good. You and Nancy get on an airplane, fly to Austin. Edith and I will pick you up, and we're going to spend the day together. Well, I was over the moon. And so that is what happened. We stayed with them at their home in Onion Creek Country Club here in Dallas. We went out to the Hill Country and played golf at Willie Nelson's golf course, about which Willie Nelson once famously said, "Par here is whatever I tell it, whatever I say it is." Yesterday, as a matter of fact, par for the front nine was 46, and I birdied two holes and shot 44. So, got to meet Willie Nelson at that point, and we just had the best time with Coach Royal. He developed Alzheimer's late in his life. And the last time I got to see him, I was doing a Texas Villanova basketball game at home here in Austin at the Irwin Center. And Bill Little, who was the SID at Texas, came over to me and he said, the coach is here. He's up in a booth up two stories up. He's having a really good day. why don't I come and get you at halftime? We'll have 6-7 minutes where a guy knows the back way up there, and you can say goodbye to him. So Bill Little and I took an elevator, went up. I walked in. Coach was having a good day. I got to tell him I loved him, give him a hug, and he hugged me back, and that was the last time I saw him. But I love that man.
And, Mark, you and I have told some stories growing up in the media, but Vern once told me that also when he was covering Coach Royal got mad at him about and called up and berated him. And apparently Mrs. Royal heard it and then proceeded to get madder at Coach Royal. And, Vern, I believe that the phone rang shortly thereafter and Coach Royal was apologizing, wasn't he?
That's right, David. This was in 64, my second year here, and he had three football players who had gone to a local motel on the interstate and were drunk, and it was 1 o'clock in the morning, and they pounded on doors, and some poor fella happened to be a Texas A&M visiting professor, and they just beat the guys to a bloody pulp. Well, they were arrested. It was front page news, and the local TV station where I was working moved me to the top of the newscast to report on the story. And I got home. I was living with my mom and dad here. And the phone rang, and my mom said, it's for you, and it was Coach Royal. He went into me, and he said, you're trying to destroy my program with crap like that. And I said, Coach, it's news. He said, no, it's not news. It's three guys. I said, there are three athletes. I said, if Joe Whoa has a heart attack in downtown Congress, we don't talk about it. But if you have a heart attack in downtown, it's going to be the lead story. Same with this. And he said, no. Well, then about, 3 weeks later, there was a continuance. And I was asked to lead the newscast again. I swallowed hard and said, I remember the three guys' names, and that there had been a postponement of the trial. Well, I get home, have dinner, phone rings. Mom says, it's for you. Vern, this is Daryl. Edith tells me I was wrong to get into your case 2 weeks ago, so I just wanted to call and apologize. Well, if I thought a lot of him before that, then he went into, elevator heaven. I mean, he just shot up. And I knew him really well.
The legendary Vern Lundquist, kind enough to join us here on Miller and Moulton. So you get the Masters gig. Is this kind of like Al Michaels getting hockey at the Olympics? They called you, said, have you ever done this before? You said, 3-4 times, and they went, fine. You got it.
Yeah, that was kind of it. I don't mean to be too ridiculous with this whole story, but I got the call on December 1st of 1982, and it was Frank Cherkinian, a gruff Armenian-American. Gruff doesn't begin to describe him. We called him the Ayatollah, partly out of respect, but mostly out of absolute fear. And he had a gruff way of speaking. He said, Lundquist, I like your work. I'm going to put you on golf. And he said, in that same tone of voice, here are your assignments: Pebble Beach, Jack's Tournament in Ohio, the Byron Nelson, the Colonial, and, oh, yes, you're going to work Augusta. But because that's going to be your first golf tournament with us, I want you to come out west a week before Pebble Beach and do the Phoenix Open, because I want you to – the Pebble is a high-profile event. The Phoenix Open is going to be on opposite the Super Bowl, and nobody will be watching. So you can work with our guys. So Nance and I flew out to Phoenix on a Wednesday. We didn't do cable then. And we went on the air on Saturday afternoon. I was in the 16th hour. And here at 18, we're Pat Summerall and Ken Venturi. At 17, Ben Wright and Tom Weisskopf. I was at 16, Steve Melnick at 15. And I looked at Nancy and I said, this is the big time. And things went well right away. I melted with the group, and they seemed to accept me. And so the five guaranteed events, which were six with the addition of Phoenix, they kept asking me back, and I was relishing it. But the five guaranteed events before the first year was out became 17, and I became a regular member of the CBS Golf family. And I do think, in retrospect, getting golf was the impetus for a lot of what happened later in my life and my career. So it's been a blessing 39 times over, and will be the 40th time here shortly.
Vern, when you first started doing the Masters, was Augusta Augusta? I lived in Atlanta in the early 90s, and I remember practice round tickets were not difficult to get. It wasn't the lottery that it is now, the craziness that it is now. So when you first went to Augusta, just how different was it then than it is now?
Well, my first one was 83. I missed two in 1997 and 98. We had a regime change at CBS, and when we lost the NFL in 1994, I stayed for a year at CBS and then accepted an offer to go to Turner Broadcasting and work the NFL and college and NBA basketball and other things. So in the meantime, I was doing 20 figure skating events with Scott Hamilton. We were counter programming against the NFL on Fox, and we were doing okay. I mean, they could sell advertising. So in my mind, I stayed at CBS, but in the mind of management, no, I was with the other guys. So I didn't work 97, 98. All I did was miss Tiger's first win. But anyway, and then I went back in 98 after we got the rights to the NFL back. But to your question, dramatically different. Just the rules and regulations were much more stringent then than they are now, I think. And hey, it's their tournament. It is the best run tournament in the world. There's nothing comparable because of the way the membership cares about the course and the people who come there. But tickets were never easy, even back then. They might have been in the 60s. But even in the early 80s when I started, you had to know somebody. Fortunately, now I know people. I did an event last night here in Austin with one of my dear, dear, dear friends, David Faraday. And we did a fundraiser for the Headliners Foundation here in Austin. And David and I got a few stories about him. We were housemates for 11 years at Augusta. And I knew him before and after. And I say that in the context of David has some demons. And he was an alcoholic and addicted to opioids. And his second marriage, and she was there last night too, his wife Anita, his gorgeous, beautiful, wonderful wife, Anita. She turned his life around. They've been married 26 years. And anyway, David joined us in 97, the year I missed. And then he stayed until he went to CBS, to NBC. But, and now he's with LIV Golf. Talk about an elephant in the room. It came up last night, obviously, but not in any kind of a derogatory term. And I asked David, incidentally, I'm getting sidetracked here, but how he sees this whole thing working out with LIV and PGA Tour. And he said, I can't predict it. He said, something's going to work out, but God knows, let's hope it does. So, my first 2 years at Augusta, I did the 13th hole. Well, hello. That's kind of pleasant, and I wound up over the years. I did every hole on the second nine except 10 and 18. But for the last 25 years, I've been 16, and I wouldn't trade that place for anything. And David was talking last night about his perch at 15 for all the years he was with us and what he could see around him. Well, at 16 in the tower, I can see third shots on 15. I can see tee shots and second shots on 17. I also cover the par 3 6, which is behind me. I can see tee shots on 6. I mean, I wouldn't trade my spot for anywhere. Oh, there, welcome back. The driller is here.
Oh, that's okay. We can hear him. It's the beauty of radio, talking with the legendary Vern Lundquist. So you're in the 17th tower after Frank Lieber dies in 86, when that is unfolding. Do you remember just what you were thinking, how you felt? I mean, like, does a nervousness come over you? You've handled, obviously, the big moments as well as anybody who's ever done your craft. And I'm just wondering, you know, what's your thought process during that? Do you make notes? Because your first huge national moment was probably Jack on Sunday in 86. Do you just remember what you were thinking?
Well, I'll try to make it really a quick story. In those days, the front of the production truck has a producer to the far left, the director in the middle, and the technical director on the far right. And in this case, the producer and the director were the same guy. There's the aforementioned Frank Cherkinian. And on the second row was his associate producer and the two other guys. But Lance Barrow, his nickname was Buddha. He's a man of rather hefty girth. And Jack had a mundane first 8 holes. He started 4 back his seve. He's even par through 8. He birdies the 9th. And Lance Barrow, Buddha, says to Frank, I've got Jack with a birdie on 9. And Frank stood up, turned around. He said, Buddha, we're in the storytelling business here, and Jack Nicklaus is not part of this story. Okay? Glared at it. Turned around. They went away. Jack comes to 10. He birdies 10. Buddha screwed up his courage again, said, Frank, I've got him on 10 with a birdie. And Frank just turned around and glared at him. Then he birdied 11. And Buddha said one more time, Frank, he's birdied 3 in a row. Well, that time, Frank kind of went, okay. And they went back and they played 9, 10, and 11 in order. And I guarantee you, after that, Jack Nicklaus did not take a step on Augusta National. Oh, boy. That driller's back.
No, it's fine.
Without us, we documented every step of his way. So I could almost recount everything he did on the back nine, but he was chasing Ballesteros. And Jack eagled the 15th, birdied the 16th, and he stood on the tee at 17, hit his tee shot, and after he hit his tee shot, Ballesteros put it in the water at 15 and double bogeyed the hole. So all of a sudden, here's Jack at 46 years of age, and he hits his second shot 12 feet above the hole, double breaker. And I kept it simple. What I was thinking was, for God's sake, if he birdies this hole, he's going to have the lead. And he hadn't won in 2 years. And so I said to myself, just keep it simple and get out of the way. So, you know, when he stood over the putt, I said, this is for sole possession of a lead. And then it goes in, a foot and a half away. I boldly declared, maybe, well, it was a foregone conclusion, but I hedged my bet. And then when it went in, I said, you know, the one that gets mentioned a lot, yes, sir, with a little more emphasis than that. And I know Jack quite well. He's 6 months older than I am. And ironically, at this function we did last night, his grandson, Jack the Third, was there. And Jack the Second was on the bag with Jack Nicklaus in 86. So I got to meet, now I know, three generations of Nicklauses. But you know, my professional career is forever going to be tied to Jack and Tiger Woods, because he chipped in at 16 in 2005, and I was the guy lucky enough to be on that call. And let me assure you both, there are worse things in life than to have your career impacted by guys named Jack Nicklaus and Tiger Woods.
Well, no kidding. And obviously the chip by Tiger, you couldn't, unlike Jack with a 12-foot putt that you thought might go in, there's no way you think the chip's going in. So what are you thinking when he chips that ball? What are you even trying to, what's the story you were thinking about telling before he hits that miraculous shot?
Well, Lanny Watkins was our guy in the tower at 18 at the time, and Tiger was playing with Chris DeMarco. And Tiger had pulled an 8-iron long and left and faced this impossible shot. DeMarco hit his tee shot 20 feet below the hole, so he's got a reasonable birdie chance. And Lanny and I did some interchange before Tiger stepped up to his shot. And Lanny said on the air, you know, he's going to be lucky if he can keep this ball inside DeMarco's ball. And so that was the thought I was thinking. Can he possibly stop it from rolling by 25, 30 feet? So he picked out a spot 25 feet above the hole to the left, and he hit the perfect chip shot. Excuse me. It bounced once, it got backspin, hopped a second time, and then began that inexorable tumble down toward the hole. And when it got to the lip of the cup, it sat there for 1.8 seconds and then dropped in. And, you know, when it did, I used the vast lexicon at my disposal and came up with a very descriptive, oh, wow. But it got a little better after that, because I said what I thought people in America were thinking. I said, have you ever seen anything in your life? Have you ever seen anything like that? Well, no, I hadn't. And I doubted that anybody at home had seen anything like that. And so that was my moment with Tiger. That and one more. They're going to run a special on Sunday at Augusta on the 2019 Tiger victory. And they sent a production crew down here, two, 3 weeks ago, to do my version or my recollections of the event. And Tiger almost holed out at 16 in 2019. And I was thunderstruck. I completely whiffed on it. I was so taken with the greatness of his tee shot that I just let that, and sometimes people at home think, thank God he shut up. But he almost got an ace on Sunday afternoon in 2019, but it went by the hole 2 feet below and was on the way, and he birdied the hole and then went on to win. And I've got vivid memories of that event and Tiger. I've got two things, guys, when we go back to Augusta here in a couple weeks. I want to introduce myself to Scotty Scheffler. I've never met him. Generational thing. And then I'm going to reacquaint myself with Tiger Woods and just say thank you. And I'll see Jack as well. But I certainly know Jack much, much better than I know Tiger. And it'll be my last time, so I want to thank the both and just say, you know, you guys had a terrific, because of your excellence, you had a terrific impact on my life, and thank you for doing that.
Well, and your golden tone certainly augmented their careers and some of their legendary accomplishments. And as a proud Texan as you are, I think you should meet Scotty Scheffler, who's also a proud Texan. So if you're going to meet somebody current on tour, Vern, that is one to meet. When, like you said, you know, I'll be remembered for certain things. Your final year of doing the SEC on CBS, when the University of Georgia honored you during a game, the band spelled out "Yes, sir," with the exclamation point on the field. That had to hit home, right?
Oh my gosh, goosebumps! I knew it was my last game at Georgia. They were playing Tennessee, and University of Georgia is one of our favorite stops. I know the people there very well. But knowing it was going to be the last one, they said the PA announcer over the system that would ask me to step to the front of the broadcast booth. And they on the Jumbotron, they played a video tribute. The governor of the state, Jack, Jim Nantz, and Kirby Smart. And then the PA announcer said, please direct your attention down on the field. And here were 425 members of the red and black band having spelled out, yes, sir. And the PA announcer said, let's do a collective goodbye. And 93,000 people in unison yelled out, yes, sir. Well, I thought I was going to start crying. I mean, just thinking about it, I still get chills. That was arranged by a dear, dear, dear friend of mine, and he and his wife, Lauren Smith and his wife, Myrna. And we've known them for 40 years, and he is the official historian of the University of Georgia Athletic Department. And a matter of fact, when we go back to Augusta, we have a forget Jim Nantz. Ours is a tradition unlike any other. On Tuesday night, we're going to do it again this year. It'll be Lauren and Myrna, Nancy and me, and a member of Augusta and his wife, Bill and Lynn Griffin, who are just wonderful people. And so we're going to have, and it's the night of the Trophy Club. It's in the Trophy Club. It is the night of the Champions Dinner. So if no other time, we'll linger after we finish until the champions come down. And I'll thank Jack and Ben Crenshaw, hostess, who's a dear friend of ours. And I'll see Tiger then if I don't see him before. So I'll have a chance to say goodbye to him and thank him. Yeah.
Well, Vern, thank you. We've enjoyed from afar listening to you. Obviously, it's one of the great gifts in my life to have met you and gotten to know you. Safe travels, you and Nancy, and soak up everything that is your 40th and final Masters. Well done, sir.
David, you are a dear friend. And Mark, I hope to get to meet you someday.
Vern, thank you so much for doing this. We really appreciate it. You're the best.
Thank you, guys.
The legendary Vern Lundquist taking time out 2 weeks before his final Masters to join us here on Miller & Moulton.